Welcome to Currents, a Norton Rose Fulbright podcast dedicated to project finance trends. I'm Todd Alexander, your host and a partner in Norton Rose Fulbright's New York office. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming back into our offices my former colleague, Scott Benk. Scott is a vice president at First American Title. He was also my law firm colleague for many years. When we were colleagues, he was my go-to guy for all things real estate related to energy financings and M&A transactions. Today, Scott's here to discuss title insurance. It's involved in almost all of the project financings that I work on, and many of the M&A deals, too. So first, a hearty welcome back, Scott.
Thank you, Todd. It was a little strange walking in. I started heading to my office, my old office.
You know, we removed the real estate guys downstairs.
Oh, it would have been a surprise, though.
All right, so anyway, so you're here. Let's start out with Title Insurance 101. What is title insurance, and what does it cover?
Title insurance, at a basic level, covers defects in title to real property. Title to real property in the United States is based on record system, which is at almost always at the county level. We search county records and other records as well to determine who the legal title holder is. Defects in the chain of title, encumbrances, liens, other exceptions to title, and ensure the insurance product covers losses resulting from what are generally described as defects, but it's all of those items.
And so if there's a problem in the chain of title and either in something that I leased and put a power plant on, or bought property and put a power plant on, and I buy insurance from you and it turns out person who I bought it from, that land's not isn't owned by them, you'll cover me for my losses?
Correct. At its most basic level, that's what title insurance is. It's losses resulting from your interest, be it a fee interest, a leasehold interest, an easement, not being vested in your client, the insured. You know, so
yeah.
It's also more expansive than that. There are a host of affirmative insurances that we offer, both for straight real estate deals, but in particular, there are coverages that are have become sort of market requirements in energy projects, and we'll get into those shortly. But they're a little bit more esoteric; they're a little bit further away from sort of the heart of what title insurance covers.
Okay, and lenders can purchase this insurance as well, right?
Correct. So there are two basic forms of title insurance or title policies. There's owner's coverage, lender's coverage. Owner's coverage covers that title is vested in the insured, again, be it a fee, a leasehold, an easement. Lender's coverage ensures the validity of the lender's lien, the mortgage or the deed of trust. So they often go hand in hand, and there are actually, when they're simultaneously issued, in almost every state, there's a price benefit, cost benefit to issuing them simultaneously, but they are covering different interests.
Okay, and I know there's always this long list of endorsements that are, you know, dealt with there. So maybe before we get into the whole endorsement process, maybe you can just tell people, you know, basically what is the process of obtaining title insurance, and then what are all these endorsements and the perform and all that? What happens?
The title insurance process starts with an order and then a search. So if you were developing a power plant, a wind farm, solar, whatever it is, there's land at issue. And you may be purchasing that land, you may be leasing that land, it may be a combination, there may be easements for transmission along with leases and maybe a fee interest in a substation. We search that land, and the search parameters vary depending on the type of project, where it is, and other factors, but we have to perform a satisfactory enough search to satisfy ourselves that we are covering enough time so that we're comfortable issuing the coverage that the client requires along with these endorsements that we'll talk about in a second. So that's sort of the basics of where we start.
So when you're doing this search, you're checking to see who owns the land, you're seeing if some utility's got the right to run a transmission line through it or a pipeline through it, even though it's not sitting there today.
That's the wrong place.
Exactly.
So we are picking up every encumbrance against that piece of property. I mean, that's the idea. Now, it's not to say that our searchers don't miss, because the records are, you know, oftentimes we're talking about searches that are going back 150, 200, 250 years. You're talking about, you know, very old books and, you know, dusty vaults, and, well, you know, there are practical difficulties in the search process. But yeah, ideally that's what the search was. Anything recorded against that particular piece of property from whenever the search begins to the present.
But if you miss, that's your problem, right?
Correct. That's right. If you're insured, unless we raise it as an exception, you're insured against it. So everything else in the world.
Right. That's why I'm paying you.
Correct. At heart, you know, we are a search company. That's the primary function of what we do. We are, for diligence purposes, oftentimes insurance is the commitment that we produce is a diligence product. It's reviewed by lawyers and consultants and surveyors to figure out what's affecting this property, whether I can build here or whether I have to relocate this or solar array to this location because of a pipeline, because of some competing interest, a prior interest. So that's what we do. I mean, that's the heart of what we do.
So I come to you. I say these are the 16 parcels I want to build on. You do your search. Then what happens?
So we do our search, and I should also mention that the search can vary in time and complexity depending on a number of factors. So that could be some weeks. It could be months. We have searches that go on over a year, you know, depending on those factors. But once we produce, say in your example, the 16 searches that for the assemblage that you're producing, we produce a title commitment. That's our commitment to insure, subject to whatever exceptions we're raising. So that's the kind of baseline product that we're starting with, and that's subject to your review. And then through the commitment process, it will be typically, it's hard to say, it depends on the size of the deal, the complexity, but there will be many iterations of that commitment. You'll look at it, we'll look at it, we'll determine that some of the exceptions are erroneous, they shouldn't have been raised, some of them may have expired by their terms, some of them may have been picked up by the searcher, but they don't actually affect that property, they were misrecorded. So we'll refine the commitment through the process of it's moving in concert with your deal process. At the end of the day, on the eve of financial close, or hopefully a day or two before, we'll produce, you mentioned earlier, a pro forma policy. That's the form of policy that we're agreeing to issue at the closing, subject to receipt of final documents, signature pages, receipt of premiums, whatever conditions are left. But typically it's at that point you're down to very few conditions prior to issuance. The pro forma policy then becomes, that's your evidence of insurance until we issue the final policy, which we issue only after recordation of the final document. So if it's a deed, a memorandum of lease, a mortgage, whatever's actually going of record. And the recordation process may take a few days, it may take some months, depending again on the jurisdiction.
Is that only when you're on the lender side for a lender's policy?
No, that's owners or lenders, because if the recordation process is, we don't have any say in that. In some jurisdictions, in much of California, we can record electronically, so we can issue the policy virtually the same day. But in some counties in Texas, it may take months to get back recorded documents. So we're sort of at the mercy of the recordation process in terms of final policy, again, for owner or lender. But importantly, you have the pro forma policy. Should something happen between issuance of the pro forma policy and issuance of the final policy, you are insured, that you're covered during that pendency.
Okay, and then before I diverted you here, where do the endorsements fit in?
So,
'cause that's the part where I always needed your help on.
So the endorsements are enhancements to coverage. Before I get to the endorsements, I'll just mention one thing about title insurance that's sort of different than almost every other form of insurance, and that is that basic title coverage is retrospective. It starts in the beginning of time, the beginning of our search, to the present, and you're covered for that period up to date of policy. So contrast that with buying an auto insurance policy, right? You buy the policy and you're covered from that day forward. So the endorsements are like the auto policy. They are, the enhancements are from date of policy forward. And there is a standard or a market package for owner's coverage in energy deals. There is a standard or market package for lenders. They're typically not very controversial. They include endorsements such as same as survey, which we're ensuring that the survey that's produced is accurately depicts the land that we're insuring, including all of the exceptions. There's access, legal access, which is the Alta 17 endorsement. There is contiguity, which is important, say, in a wind deal, where you need to know that parcel A is contiguous to parcel B, to C, to D, or a transmission line, or you know, something along those lines. Those, again, are typically not very controversial. There are, on the lender side, there are a number of, again, sort of standard non-controversial endorsements, like variable rate of interest, a doing business endorsement that the lender doesn't necessarily have to register to do business in that state for the mortgage to be deemed valid and effective as against that particular property. The ones that we always argue about, and the ones that you and I used to wrestle over, on deals here, and we continue to wrestle over, are energy transaction specific endorsements that are A, more expensive, and B, tougher to issue. Among those are what's known as the Series 36 endorsement. Series 36 refers to ALTA, which is the American Land Title Association. Those are, so they're forms. I don't know how they wound up at the 36 designation, but there's a series of endorsements that are geared towards energy projects. They offer enhanced leasehold or easement coverage because many renewable projects in particular are built on leases and easements, and sort of the regular policy doesn't cover the full measure of loss, potential measure of loss under those policies. And another very difficult coverage that we come across in almost every energy deal is mineral coverage. Some people may know, in most states, United States, the mineral estate and the surface estate are actually two different estates at law. So Todd can own the surface and Scott can own the subsurface. And there's again, depending on the state, I have rights, Scott has rights as the owner of the subsurface to access those minerals or oil and gas interests or whatever, notwithstanding that Todd owns the entire surface. So if you're erecting a wind farm, mineral coverage is maybe a little easier because you're not blanketing the earth with improvements. You're putting a turbine here, a turbine 500 yards away here, and then maybe some collector lines and a substation. So we can get comfortable, or we often can get comfortable with mineral, offering mineral coverage for, those, but say look at a power plant, which is, which will cover virtually the entire surface of a particular parcel, or solar, which will cover, basically blanket the earth with panels. If a subsurface holder wants to access its minerals, there can be a real problem.
And the issue, I remember we had this on a deal you know, where if somebody had subsurface rights and the question was if they ever wanted to use them, could they then force you to, you know, just tear right through the solar farm?
And the answer may be yes. Again, it's state specific, but in many states, the mineral estate is considered the dominant estate. And dominant law is not the same thing as sort of common law, English dominant, but the subsurface holder has rights, typically reasonable surface rights to access the subsurface. So developers and have come up with techniques, and we underwrite around these techniques, such as in solar, for instance, it's now fairly common for drill islands to be placed. So we'll work with, or the developer will work with a consulting firm, maybe an oil and gas consulting firm or a mineral consulting firm, and they'll analyze production in the area, likelihood of production in this particular location, and they'll come up with a set-aside area or maybe strategically placed drill islands that will allow for subsurface access. But it's definitely case by case. It's probably the toughest issue for title companies. Well, it is the toughest issue for title companies in non-construction deals. The other issue, which we'll get to in a second, is another set of endorsements surrounds mechanics liens, but that's only when there's
Why don't we talk about that? Because that one's always problematic.
It is. A mechanics lien is a right in almost every state of a contractor, a supplier, to lien a project site, to file an action against the particular real estate that they're working on to collect payment for work performed and not paid for. Again, every state has some form of mechanics lien statute. Almost every state provides that mechanics liens have some level of super priority. So, meaning that they can jump ahead of other monetary liens, including mortgages and deeds of trust. So in a construction loan scenario where the lender is loaning a sum of money, but it's going to be advanced in monthly or quarterly as needed to fund construction, and a mechanics lien arises, again, depending on the state, that mechanics lien can gain priority over the lien of the mortgage or deed of trust.
So let's just break this down a little, just make it easier for people to understand. So I'm a lender, I'm going to lend $100 million to a project to get it built. I'm going to lend, just to make it simple, I'm going to lend in four disbursements of $25 million each. I see on day one, you do your title search, everything comes up clean. So the lender says, oh, this is fantastic. They lend the first $25 million, now some contractor goes out to the site, starts doing work, and the next thing I know, the contractor says, I haven't been paid $5 million, I'm filing a mechanics lien against the project. So now what happens, that lien could potentially trump me as the lender, and I'm upset.
Correct. So that lien, at law, could prime the $100 million mortgage. It seems sort of crazy, but that is how mechanics lien laws often work, depending on the state. So that mechanic, that contractor, has a right to foreclose that lien with priority above your $100 million.
So as a secured lender, what does First American do to help me out here so I don't have to worry about this?
So as I started to say, when we first started working together, pre-2008, it was common to get what we call upfront mechanics lien coverage. So blanket mechanics lien coverage. And in fact, when I started practicing law, before iPhones and time stamping, somebody, and often it was me as the junior associate on a deal, would actually go to the site with a newspaper, and somebody would take a picture of the site with no work, and the date of the newspaper establishing that priority hadn't been broken, construction hadn't started as of that date.
What's the importance of that?
The importance of that is that in many states, not all states, in many states, the mechanics lien statutes are relation-back statutes, meaning that the first contractor to set foot on the site or the first supplier to deliver materials to the site establishes priority for every contractor or supplier who shows up on the site from that day forward. So the painter who's doing finishing work 18 months later and is not paid, his lien rights relate back to the date and time when the first guy stepped on the job. That's why we would try to establish priority via some evidence that no work had started. Very unscientific way of doing it, but that was the standard then. And mechanics lien losses for title companies were smaller at that time. And then 2008 financial crisis came and mechanics lien claims exploded. And in fact, still true now that there is no category of loss in commercial deals for title companies that comes close in terms of claims or payments than mechanics liens. That is our number one concern, and nothing's even close. You asked what we do now to help you. What we do now is a form of coverage called pay-as-you-go coverage or interim coverage, or also referred by this ALTA numbers, ALTA 32, 33 coverage. And basically what that is that with each advance of money, so in your example, each $25 million advance, we would date down the mechanics lien coverage. We would perform a search of the records from our prior search to that date, or as close to that date as we can get, depending on availability of records. We would then ask for lien waivers. We would ask for proof of payment. You know, we would try to reconcile. We have a group at First American that this is all that they do. They sort of reconcile. They review construction advance packages and reconcile the money being spent versus the money being advanced. And we try to bring forward the coverage to the date of the advance. So, and then we would do the same thing with the next $25 million advance and so on. To provide that coverage, though, and this is often, that part's not so controversial, typically. The part that often is controversial is that there's generally an indemnity required. It's going to come from a credit indemnitor, it's almost never can be a project company level indemnity. Title companies aren't in the credit business. This is sort of an adjunct of what we do, as we talked about earlier. The endorsements are sort of enhanced coverages. If there's no credit indemnity, it's a very difficult coverage to offer.
So what do you do when you're dealing with private equity or people like that, or somebody who's just a startup who doesn't have somebody creditworthy who can give an indemnity?
We either don't give the coverage, so that the lender has to get comfortable without that coverage, which is not advantageous for anybody. B, if it's private equity, we try to talk somebody into, or the project try to talk somebody into providing an indemnity, and it may be a limited indemnity, and we'll modify the coverage in some way to make it more limited, but it won't be the sort of broad coverage that we talked about earlier. We have seen some deals where the EPC contractor will provide the indemnity on the basis that it basically already has that obligation under the EPC to keep the job lien free. So we ask that the EPC contractor extend that obligation to the title company.
So isn't this, I guess I'm being blunt, but isn't this the title company just trying to front for whatever that indemnity is? They're just taking the credit risk because the project could have got the same indemnity from somebody else and not gone through you.
Yeah, but the parties like the title company's balance sheet.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, but that's they're basically fronting for somebody else.
Correct. And indemnity, but indemnities, as you know, are there are challenges in collecting. So it's a nice to have, and again, it's difficult to do the deal without one. But yeah, but if there, you know, when it hits the fan on a mechanics lien claim, the title company is the first one to get the call.
So let's talk about costs. So one thing is, you know, which I used to always go to you to ask for your advice on, you know. One is how do you structure the package in a way that's most cost effective, and how much coverage really should you buy?
So, two parts to that question. So, pricing in general breaks down along state lines. Some states are filed rate or fully regulated states, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, New Jersey, where the price is the price. If you want to buy X amount of insurance, this is what it costs. If you want to buy these endorsements, that's what it costs. Texas is also in that category. California, many of the western states, much of New England are negotiated rate states. And so there, the title companies are generally very competitive with one another. Doesn't tend to be a lot of variance in, you know, what we charge versus what our competitors charge. There's a market in each of those states, and it very much depends on deal size. So a smaller deal in California may cost $1.50 a thousand, and a very large deal may be 50 cents a thousand. And 50 cents a thousand is the coverage, you know, of whatever coverage you're buying, which leads to the second part of your question of how do you determine how much to cover. So, generally speaking, lender's coverage is the amount of the loan. There are exceptions to that. Some sponsors, some developers are able to negotiate for something less than that, but I would say very much market is the amount of the loan. And then owner's coverage can vary. You're not going to get it for less than the loan amount because, as I mentioned earlier, simultaneous issuance rates are such that if you buy a $100 million owner's policy, your $100 million loan policy is, it's not free, but it's nominal in many states, most states. But your question is how much to buy above the $100 million. So many developers, many sponsors will buy insurance for their full equity commitment, the loan plus whatever equity is being injected into the deal. There are others that will try to insure real property value. And often in our deals, it's difficult to determine what's real property versus what's is a turbine installed real property or personalty. So there's actually another endorsement for that. There's something called the Alta 31 Severable Improvements Endorsement, which if we issue, we'll say that essentially the title company will not argue that something is real or something is personal property. We will pay the claim, if there's a claim, as if everything that we insured is real property. So some developers or some sponsors will look to that sort of calculation of real property value. Others will look at hard costs. What would it cost me to build it again? EPC contracts, subcontractors, materials, but not legal fees or other consultants, figuring that they're not recoverable under a title policy. So there's a couple different ways to skin that cat. There are technical reasons why you don't want to underinsure as an owner. The most important among those is that below a certain percentage of quote-unquote value, you can be deemed a co-insurer under the policy. So if you underinsure by 30%, you may be responsible, or we may argue that you're responsible for 30% of the losses of a claim, and we're going to pay on the 70.
Right, you were basically self-insuring part of it yourself.
Correct.
Yeah. So you were just using us as a search function instead of an insurer.
Correct.
In part.
That's right. And also, along those same lines, part of our obligation under the title policy is to provide litigation support. If you were sued by somebody, a pipeline running through the property, and the pipeline operator said you should have never built there, and you file a title claim, and you know we fight it on your behalf, we're responsible for those litigation costs under the policy. But we're not going to sell a litigation policy. We're only going to provide that coverage if we've been, again, insured for quote-unquote full value.
So as in a closing question for you, just to figure out what parts of the policy really are the most important, where are the aspects beside liens that you guys wind up really having to pay out?
In addition to mechanics lien claims, particularly for energy projects, the claims generally fall into a couple different categories. We've had a number of significant mineral claims for the reasons we talked about earlier, interfering with the subsurface rights. Encroachments is another one. One of those Series 36 endorsements I mentioned ensures against forced removal of improvements because of an encroachment against a pipeline or some other pre-existing improvement or right. And there's been a number of significant claims in the industry over those. And then another category, which is a little bit more esoteric but important to mention, is non-imputation. And that's an important coverage in tax equity. I'll just spend a second on that. The knowledge of the insured is imputed to the entity. Tax equity is coming in as an investor into the project company entity, so the knowledge of the developer is imputed to the tax equity.
So because they're partners.
Correct, so they're partners, but the tax equity argument is, hey, we don't know anything about this project. The developer did everything. We're just the money.
They were passive partners.
Correct. So tax equity requires a non-imputation endorsement when they come into the deal, which says that notwithstanding that we're partners, the knowledge of the developer is not imputed to me for purposes of making a claim under this policy. And there's been a number of significant coverage claims and cases around that issue also, that not just tax equity, but non-imputation is prevalent in real estate deals as well, where there's a lot of passive money that's coming into a building, a shopping center. So that coverage has been around a long time, but in energy deals we see it most often, and there have been significant claims in the energy space with tax equity.
So that I understand the claim, the structure of the claim is their partner knew that there was an easement running here, but the tax equity didn't. You insured said there wasn't, and then they try to say...
Correct. We try to deny the claim on the basis that the insured, the project company, had knowledge of the defect or didn't disclose the defect, and the tax equity investor said, wait a second, I'm an additional insured under this policy. I get to make a claim irrespective of the developer, and their knowledge is not imputed to me. That's along with some of the other mineral coverage, encroachment coverage we talked about, that mechanics lien coverage, that's also a controversial coverage and an expensive coverage, and will also require an indemnity almost always. We don't issue that coverage lightly because we don't know anything about the project coming in. As between the developer and tax equity, they both know far more than we do. So we will issue that coverage, but it has not been without, you know, some significant claim experience.
All right. Well, with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. I think we it's more than enough than we can digest. It's great to have you back in the office, and hopefully we'll have you back again soon. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
You can find us online or send us an email at currents@nortonrosefulbright.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or your preferred podcast app. Our show today was produced by Emily Rogers, and I'm Todd Alexander.
Stay ahead of the currents.